Reflection cost. I want you to read the rest of that line. We don't have any longer paper files where we go to the file and pull out a piece and run to the copy machine and say, here. There is the microfiche process, and that's also part of that. We're not. I know film is separate, but the microfiche, the reader and printer, is included, and that's an expensive process. It takes an operator. Now, we would encourage anyone, the attorney, the state agency, if we could just have a conversation about what they really wanted. We might eliminate and screen out the fishing expedition. We printed a brochure 3 years ago, provided it to every state agency. Some of them still use it. And the first instruction on there, this was how to get records from a bank and save money. Because we had problems with state agencies saying, I can't afford these reasonable costs. So we told them the steps to go through, and many of them have said it has saved them a ton of money because it says contact the bank, talk about what you're after, and we can help you zero in on it. Now, I will tell you that one of the problems we had originally in looking at the Oregon League of Financial Institutions bill is this will reduce costs that some banks are now considering reasonable. Not every bank in this state is on a computer. That may surprise some people, but I can take you to a bank that is still hand-posted. Now you try these reimbursements and make them reasonable over in Eastern Oregon, and it will take weeks for them to comply with certain subpoenas. Not every bank has a central office. Some of them have to go through a great deal of detail. So reasonable costs, as far as agencies are concerned, have varied all over the place. But the fact of the matter, the problem has become severe. And this is the federal reimbursement schedule, and it makes sense to treat state agencies and state subpoenas the same way that they're treated on the federal level.
Further questions from the committee? This is a public hearing.
It is. Okay, so I do get it.
Representative Burke.
I'm always bothered when I see bills come through that sets fees in them because next session we're going to come back and move it up. If there's a federal schedule, is there a way that this could be, those fees could be set at just whatever the prevailing federal rate is rather than, and then that it goes up rather than us having to sort of tag along behind, or is that something that wouldn't be?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton, I'm not a constitutional attorney. You always have the delegation of authority question to a federal agency here.
We got around that in the committee here recently.
Yeah, I think there are ways to get around it. Certainly acceptable to us if that was the committee's desire to just peg it through. The problem is that you make some reference to Regulation S. Regulation S is repealed, and they put in double C, and they're doing the same thing, and you've got the wrong reference.
Chair,
Representative Burke.
There was also, in the previous hearing on this, I was not present, but apparently there was a testimony by Mr. Brooks of the Corporation Division. His concern was prior payment and walking the check through and all of that. Do you have any problems with that?
Your Honor, as a resident expert.
Well, Representative Burton, I understand that concern. Talk to him in the hallway afterwards. I think we need to accommodate that kind of problem. By the same token, I think there needs to be a motivation for the requestor and the institution to have a conversation up front. One way it could be accommodated, I suppose, I think there are job orders that state agencies use when they spend money. What we need is an incentive for a conversation to occur on the front end. And I'll tell you that the day of us just rolling over and playing dead and sending a bill after it's over with and being told, oh, we forgot to tell you, we didn't need that, or I'm sorry, here's your $5, sue us, I can tell you that day is over. We're not going to play that game. This is not, could not ever be a profit center. This is not the business we're in.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton, when we attorneys go down to the county courthouse to file a case, we get out with a check and we fill it out right. I mean, they don't send us a bill later. We don't file or ask for records. Go down and ask for some copies of some records and say, would you please bill us? It's cash on the barrel head, or they may have a firm may have an account that they can draw against. But it's getting to the point where it's just getting out of hand. That's the problem. That's why we bring this bill to you now rather than some previous time. Thank you.
One question.
I'm sorry, Representative.
One more question. Wind up question. On, I guess it's line 20. Does this cover database printers as well as microcomputers? I'm not sure. You say by reader and printer reproduction processes, and I don't. Is that an inclusive term that has familiarity somewhere else in the definition, so that you're not going to have a problem if you have a micro or database printout?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's right out of the federal regulation. That's their words of art.
And I might add that there are some microfiche that have printers attached. There are.
But there are also computers that have printers attached.
Yes, that's right.
We're covering both of them.
We're covering both.
Question.
Chair, could I just make a comment?
In 1 minute.
Sure. It seems to me that a lot of the financial institutions' concern, and I think it's a concern that goes beyond financial institutions, is this, what I call discovery abuse. People who are misusing the process to do things that end up with costs that are unfair. And it seems to me that probably if what the remedy should be is to supplement the existing rule of civil procedure with some stringent sanctions that can be imposed on people who engage in discovery abuse and do the kinds of things that Mr. Barrow's talked about. That would put reasonableness, or should put reasonableness, on behalf of attorneys. At the same time, it would leave the existing structure for determining whether, if you have a reasonable request, who bears the cost of it.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you very much for your testimony today. Okay, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2667. We have a hearing on House Bill 2520. Mr. Sitzma is here. Representative Anderson signed up and stated that his testimony from last session.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Leonard Sitzma. I'm an assistant administrator of the Adult and Family Services Division. I testified previously at a hearing on this bill. I really have nothing more to add. My primary reason for signing up was to let you know I was here, and if there are any questions, any elaboration I can give or anything like that, but I see no particular advantage in repeating to you what I said the first time.
Are there questions, counsel?
Yeah, I'd like to bring to the subcommittee's attention, you have before you a request for information regarding financial status supplied by Mr. Smitska. It's a release, and what this allows AFS to do is, if they know there's a bank account, they can go over to the bank account and inspect the bank account. And if I can ask Mr. Smith a question? Excuse me for mispronouncing your name. I know the problem. What the bill is seeking is to go into those bank accounts that are not reported to AFS. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, counsel, the purpose of this bill is to try and discover where bank accounts exist that we don't know about. That's a primary reason. Correct.
Thank you.
There is one little further tag to that, in that In the case of child support, even if we know the institution where the bank account is, we are unable, in most cases, since it's an adversary relationship in terms of trying to collect the child support, to get the holder of that account to sign a release.
Questions? I'm sorry, I have to, let me ask about this release form that we have. This is the authorization form by AFS to recipient, public assistance recipient, signs upon application.
That's correct.
So if I sign up for public assistance as a regular course of signing up, I will also sign one of these releases.
Mr. Chairman, we would ask about bank accounts since there are limits on the amount of resources you may have. And if the applicant identifies, yes, I do have an account at such and such a bank, then the assistance worker would fill out the top portion of that indicating, you know, bank so-and-so, and they would sign it, giving us the authority to check on that account.
And what 2520 says that... just in case, well, if you would be able to go to a bank that is not listed, or to that, yeah, to a bank not listed, help me out here, and that bank would have to respond as to whether there's a
Chairman,
account that...
Under the conditions in 2520, that's correct.
Okay, further questions? No, this is just listed as a hearing today. Representative Springer?
I just wanted to note that this is one of those files and bills that I've received a little pink slip from the Downs Area Chamber of Commerce Government Affairs Committee, and it bears the date March 13th, 1985, and it's addressed to myself, Representative Miller, Representative Fabusch, and Senator Jernstedt. The subject is this bill relating to disclosure of financial records, and the Chamber of Commerce position was 1 in favor, 9 opposed, and 1 undecided, and it's signed by Mr. Keith, who's chair of that group with an address in the Dallas, Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I will tell you that I know that committee, and if they understood the bill, it would be all in favor.
Representative Byrd.
The bill provides for reimbursement to financial institutions to be made under ORS 192-580. Is that the $5 subpoena reimbursement, or would this...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Burton, I'm embarrassed because in listening to the previous testimony, I looked through everything I had. I don't have that reverence with me, and I cannot answer your question.
The thing that's... This obviously, in looking at the form that we filled out here, there is some time involved in filling out, probably fairly simply, on savings and checking, as long as we know it's just certain periods of time and it's got closing balances.
Yes.
That's no problem. That's just like a loan request. But stocks and bonds are listed on here. Sale value, dividends, amounts, that sort of thing, and that would require, I assume, some further, if they're held with or through the banks, which they may or may not be. I don't know whether the bank or financial institution would have that, would be able to directly, or what the definition of stock and bond is in this case. I can see where it could get into something more than a final retrieval. You don't know that, so maybe we need to get that information. You can let us know back.
Mr. Bronner can help us out a little bit here.
Good. I would agree that in some of it could run more than $5. I don't have any argument with that.
Chairperson, members of the committee, Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. If you look at the definition of financial institution, line 16 on page 1, this definition includes investment companies or authorized to do business under the Investment Company Act of 1940. So it would also include Representative Burton brokerage houses.
I see.
It would also include any stocks, bonds held with a bank trust company. You're correct in that. But it would primarily focus in the area of stocks and bonds with the brokerage houses. If I may, Mr. Chairperson, there's a, for the record, I've got a couple concerns that I need to have on the record. The first is on line 19, page 2, violation of section 2 is a violation punishable by a fine of $50. I would assume and believe the bill intent that if the Human Resources Department did in fact violate section 2, they would be subject to a $50 fine. Because let's assume that they don't have the written certification, but they certify to us that they do. That's a violation, in my opinion, of section 2, and my question would be, they would then be subject to the $50 fine. We commend the department for understanding our plight with the production of records, and 192.582 would give us reasonable costs. We can set forth those reasonable costs, but choose not to at this time. The final concern, I think, looking at my notes, on line 5, we suggest to the committee that you delete without notice to the customer. You put us in a terrible, terrible situation with regard to due process. Under normal circumstances, we do have the option, unless there is a criminal investigation, and the department can do that on a without even authorization. But here you've got the authorization of the customer to search. We don't mind, some of us would not call the customer, but some of us would want to. Depends. I think we ought to be more specific. Either you tell us not ever to call a customer under this, or give us the opportunity, if we choose to advise the customer.
Further questions? Representative Burton?
You guys want to get out of here, but on the question of notice or without notice, I'm wondering if the without notice question is for concern that if you do give notice to the customer, I understand due process question and I appreciate that, but let's say the notice is given, does that allow a person to run down there very quickly or over the telephone, withdraw and shift money out that may show the record to be different than perhaps that person wants it to be? That may, I don't know whether that was the intent of putting that in the bill. Maybe you should answer that.
I guess I should have asked, what was the intent of that language?
Maybe that's right. What is this? I don't know.
Do you want to help us out?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, especially in relation to child support. One of the reasons is not criminal in trying to locate a bank account, but we're trying to collect support money which the court has ordered the individual to pay. We not only have to find the bank account, okay, but then we have to put an attachment on it or do something. And what we're quite often, or part of what we're after here, is to try and find that bank account. And the reason for not notifying the individual in that specific instance is we want to know the bank account's there and then take some action without having the individual remove the money and not have it available.
I don't know. Good argument for the last bill, you realize.
Pardon me?
So you're making a good argument for the last bill.
Yeah.
Well, very quickly, let me explain our difficulty, the term without notice to the customer. Let's say that the discovery is there, that there is a checking account, and the department moves as they are justified to move, and grab the money. And we've got a customer out there writing checks on an account that doesn't have any money in it anymore. How do we accomplish notifying the customer he's writing NSF checks when we can't give him notice? In other words, we've got a little problem.
Mr. Chairman, I can see no reason that we would object to notice to the customer if we in fact attach the bank account or something like that, so that I would agree they're entitled to know there's no money there. I don't have a problem with that. It's the notice that we've asked about it that we're really concerned the customer not.
Representative Burton.
Hopefully they'll sit down.
Council.
I just want to advise the the committee, the subcommittee, that as Mr. Hunter testified at last hearing, there are possible criminal sanctions for, say, misleading AFS or misleading child support. And with or without notice, what you're doing is allowing the inspection of bank accounts without a search warrant or a subpoena. And there's a due process problem.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Why don't we close the hearing on 2520? Thank you. We return quickly to a work session. We have Mr. Carter, who has been with us all afternoon, has been anxiously awaiting work session on House Bills 2361, 2649. I think, yes, do you want to, just in case there are any questions, Council, you want to help us out on 2361?
Yes, Mr. Chairperson. You have in front of you a Hannah Gross copy of 2361. It has what I call the Burns-Cosgrove Amendments, clarify some definitions. There's also a deletion by Gene Grant of the Oregon State Bar to not include interest in case of installments. And that was rewritten as a new definition or revised definition in the amendments. We have in front of you a copy of the Hannah Gross version of the bill. I will also pass out some correspondence from Mr. Carter.
Actually, I just relayed that. It's from Tom Hillier on behalf of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar in support of that bill.
Mr. Burns, Cosgrove. Mr. Burns and Paul Cosgrove.
Ask you, Mr. Carter, in terms of the forfeiture aspect of this, we would be relying on the seller to file the affidavit. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And you think that a better approach would be just to allow the strict foreclosure proceeding and do away with this provision in the bill, this forfeiture remedy provision, and just go with a strict foreclosure lawsuit?
I think the feeling of the real estate and land use section of the Oregon State Bar was that the forfeiture remedy may be a beneficial addition to the strict foreclosure and specific performance remedies that could be obtained, and that it may be a reason why someone would be willing to sell property for a lower down payment than they otherwise would. That provides another remedy that makes the contract distinct, and that the forfeiture remedy is unique and is beneficial.
Representative Bellamy.
Are these amendments different than when the last time we had the hearing?
Yes, they are.
Mr. Chair, I have to say, I really appreciate the time and effort, but I am uncomfortable voting on things just because the Real Estate Division of the Oregon State Bar says we should, and I can never get, on both this bill and the next bill, I can never get a handhold and what we're doing because it constantly changes. I can't get back to my people when the bill continues to change, and we unfortunately deal with a law that has the potential of, for all the right reasons, do a lot of harm.
If I could respond, Mr. Chair.
Sure, Mr. Carter.
The amendments that were proposed by Burns Cosgrove, that were submitted by Paul Cosgrove on behalf of the Oregon Financial services. I may not have the right organization, but they were not presented by the bar. The bar had a bill, and those amendments were presented in response to the Estate of Brewer decision of the Oregon Supreme Court, and they are intended to address the related issues of what happens when there's an abandonment or a strict foreclosure, and who has to be notified before an abandonment can occur, or a strict foreclosure, or other remedy can occur. So I recognize that the confusion that can be caused by those amendments, I think that they can be viewed merely as completing what the bar intended to try to do with the forfeiture remedy, but they are somewhat different.
Well, I know, I don't know, Mr. Carter, if you're appearing here necessarily as the proponents of these amendments. I don't want to stick you with that title if you're not entirely comfortable with that. One of the amendments I note on page 2, section 3, would substantially reduce, it appears, the requirement or obligation to give notice or to try to provide notice to or when there is a default under a contract. And I think I can understand that there may be a cost with that notice, obviously, but certainly the impact of such a forfeiture on the purchaser is substantial, and I for one, I'm very concerned that every opportunity in terms of notice is made just to avoid consequences. At some point down the line, if there isn't notice given, and it's determined, however, that the statutory notice was sufficient, I mean, the possibility of some person not having actual notice becomes greater, I think, and it's going to make more problems down the line for others. I like Representative Bellamy, unfortunately, hadn't had an opportunity to review these before the hearing, and I know it puts you at a tremendous disadvantage, and I know you've been here all day, but I kind of feel the same way Representative Bellamy does to some extent.
Okay, let me just say then, why don't we, would Tuesday work session be soon enough or enough time? Let me just say that I think, quite frankly, it's because of the fact that we purchased our home on a contract situation. You know, there are no guarantees in the statute, and I think fortunately, because my wife's an attorney and have an interest in the law and that, and I read contracts and all that, we put a lot of stuff in that was never mentioned by a real estate agent that was to our advantage and also to the seller's advantage as well, because things were spelled out, so we both knew, and I think we'll be doing a lot of Oregonians a service by adopting some minimums.
Well, Mr. Chair, I agree with that. But the only people that we've had testified on these two bills is, and he's done it in good faith, but it's been representatives of the bar. I still don't understand the bills. I don't understand the mechanics of the bills, because every time we come here, they change.
Okay.
And I want to tell you that just because an attorney does it, I don't have that confidence that it's going to be done correctly. And I have sent these back to the title companies. One of my title companies, maybe not this bill, but both of them deal, wrote back and had some strong concerns. I, last week, sent it to Norm Webb, who is a real estate attorney here in town, considered one of the best, teaches real estate law. He's just in the response of responding to me. And now I see with both bills we have his response doesn't mean anything, because now we've changed the bill again in proposed amendments. And I know that you've worked in good faith, but legislatively, we cannot pass bills on good faith.
Well, I've had the advantage of being able to consult with a couple of individuals who work in this area, and I feel fairly comfortable with this, at least in terms of moving it to full. I will set this over till Tuesday. I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairperson. Because of the notice requirement, there's no way to give them 24 on that.
Because this is Friday. Sorry, it's Friday. That's plenty of time.
And I only got one other suggestion. There's got to be some effort by some individuals to go through these bills, and I offer time so that I understand them, and so that I understand that we are doing something that's truly in the benefit of people, not just to the benefit of attorneys.
Representative Bellamy, I think this bill would reduce the litigation, actually. It's why one of the reasons I'm interested in this very much. I think it's a consumer-oriented bill, very much so.
It may be consumer-oriented, but I guarantee you that right now most consumers would have to go hire an attorney to understand it before they could use it.
Well, I mean, I think by Friday is plenty of time for you to meet with various people whose counsel you trust, and it's not my intent to have major revisions.
Right, and my only response is that you better not bring me another set of complete new amendments. I would like to get one where I could start digesting it.
Okay. Then I think it's time to begin digesting.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a suggestion?
Counsel, yes.
These amendments are really not Mr. Carter's.
Right.
We know that.
Mr. Grant made 1 3- or 4-word amendment, and what I will try to do for you next Friday is have it